Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. And welcome back to Daniel Tokaji. He's a law professor and associate director of election law at OSU's Moritz College of Law.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
It is, of course, voting day. And primary voting day, I guess, technically. And Dan is here to talk about that, as well as Scott Britton of the League of Women Voters of Ohio. Scott, welcome to the show.
It's good to be back.
And joining us about after the first break, Matt Damschroeder, deputy director of the Franklin County Board of Elections, will be with us. He's also a member of the executive committee at the Franklin County Republican Party. And I want to ask him, who votes for the executive committee these days? So I've seen a couple signs up there. It's kind of a strange concept, don't you think, Dan?
Well, you know, it's parties occupy an interesting place in our democracy. On the one hand, they're private organizations in a sense, but on the other hand, they are quasi-government entities, right? They're critical to the functioning of our election system.
So you see those signs up there, and they don't really mean much to anybody, though. The judicial elections are bad enough.
Right. I'm sure that a lot of people are wondering not only who are these people, but what exactly do these people do?
Right.
And maybe Matt, when he gets on, can shed some light on that question. But, you know, I think you're question, Ann, raises a bigger problem, which is, you know, do we have what might be called an excessive democracy? We vote on so many things here in the United States, and in some places people vote very often. We've got, on the other hand, a smaller Republican system where we're supposed to have elected representatives who make certain decisions for us. Do we vote on too many things? I think that's a reasonable question for voters to ask on a day like today.
How do we compare to other, you know, Western countries?
I think generally we vote on a lot more things than most other Western countries vote for. In particular, for many democratic countries, the idea of voting on judges is looked on as crazy because judges are supposed to be independent of the political process. Yet in the United States, at least in many of our states, they are not. They are elected some places on a party basis, including here in Ohio. Although judges' party affiliations don't appear on the ballot, they are nominated as members of their parties.
Isn't an appointment, though, a political process as well?
Well, I would say for the League of Women Voters, we have long supported an appointive or a merit selection system because while we recognize that any system is going to have its flaws, we've looked and a lot of different groups have looked at the various systems for getting judges into office, and we believe that the merit selection system has the fewest flaws, the least room for excessive influence by other parties.
Right. What people are always worried about is influence. So if it's not the kowtowing to the voters and having to raise money from and through fundraisers, it could be that you're beholden to whoever appoints you.
I think that that is undoubtedly true to some extent, but it's a matter of degree. And when a judge knows that he or she is going to have to be subject to re-election, including a possible primary election, a partisan primary election, that is likely to have an impact on that judge's decisions. Put another way, there's an inherent conflict of interest between a judge's responsibility to discharge her or his duties impartially, without regard to partisan consequences in particular, and the likelihood that that judge is going to have to run for election. And that's especially problematic when the judge is going to have to run as a candidate for one or the other major parties.
Yes. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, the League of Women Voters believes that there can also be safeguards in such a system. We support, for example, gubernatorial appointments that are based on recommendations from a committee that examines and decides on the most eligible candidates.
That's
and
the
then
merit
forwards
part of
that
it.
List. Yes, exactly.
That was a pet project of the late Chief Justice of the Ohio Supreme Court, Thomas Moyer, who died not very long ago, just about a month ago. It was something that just before he died suddenly had been pretty much agreed that it wasn't going to go anywhere, that there wasn't enough support for it in Ohio.
Yeah. And I think the late Chief Justice Moyer, to his enormous credit, recognized that it was critical for judges to enjoy some independence from the political process, and further to recognize that in Ohio, that independence just doesn't exist at the moment. And I think that Chief Justice Moyer did a great job under the circumstances that he was faced with of trying to ensure that the Ohio Supreme Court was as independent as possible. But Chief Justice Moyer recognized that there was a structural problem with Ohio's judicial system.
Yeah,
and I think
was,
it would be a great credit to his legacy if at some point in the future we made good on that, on the tremendous things that he did by making some greater degree of insulation from partisan politics for Ohio's judiciary a reality.
So the lack of support, though, Scott, why isn't there more support for it? Because the independence argument makes complete sense.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, Ohioans like to vote. They like to vote on a lot of different candidates.
We're looping.
And the question may be, does Ohio vote for even more, not just than other Western countries, but than other states around the country? But, you know, the Chief Justice and the League of Women Voters had been working on this issue for many years. And
right.
Even though
he was not a Johnny-come-lately to it.
It had been turned down by the voters at the ballot. But in November, the Chief Justice hosted a summit with the League of Women Voters to examine this. Stakeholders came together, and they did decide to pursue an appointive and retention system for judges. And, you know, his passing, I think, has probably delayed that campaign. But I think that we certainly intend to move forward with that.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Daniel Tokaji. He is Associate Director of the Moritz College of Law at the Election Law at OSU's Moritz College of Law, and also Scott Britton of the League of Women Voters of Ohio. Joining us in a few minutes will be Matt Damschroeder, Deputy Director at the Franklin County Board of Elections. Columbus Dispatch reported today, We've known this for a few days now, that Secretary of State Jennifer Bruner has predicted a very low turnout today, about 23%. Now, that counts the early ballots, the early voting as well, right?
Yes. My understanding is that figure includes what we call here absentee ballots,
right,
and that includes both in-person and mail-in absentee ballots.
So it's a beautiful day out. Sometimes we blame it on the weather. What's the problem now? It's a primary and there's nothing really good on the ballot or what?
Well, I checked in with our League of Women Voters phone bank over at WBNS 10 TV about an hour ago, and they said the phones were a little slow this morning, but still lots of voters asking where they vote. Voters asking about the state issues. Marion County voter asking, why do I vote on changing the location of a Columbus casino?
Oh, boy.
So people do have questions. And I think that, you know, in case you want that number,
yes,
I do. 821-1010. There's a group of volunteers who are there to answer questions about, are you registered to vote? Where do you go to vote? And answer any other election-related questions that you might have.
At 614?
That's correct.
614-821-1010. That's the Ohio League of Voters of Ohio's phone bank. I guess it's a Q&A phone bank. So if you have any questions, you can give them a call at that's WBNS Channel 10 all day. And we'll post that at WOSU.org/allsides as well, if you forget. But low voter turnout, is it possible that if we didn't have so many things to vote on, there would be more turnout or less? What do you think?
I think it is certainly possible that we would have greater turnout if we didn't have as many elections. But this election is one that we can't plausibly skip, right? We've got to have, under the United States Constitution, elections every couple years for the U.S. House of Representatives. And under our two-party system, we have primary elections to select the party nominees for each of the major parties as well as third parties. So, you know, this isn't one we can plausibly skip.
Now, there's a pretty big increase in absentee voting.
Yeah.
Good, bad?
Well, from the League of Women Voters perspective, it's fantastic. I think Ohio has gone a long way in the last few years in making it easier for people to vote. You have fewer excuses now to get out there. Franklin County Board of Elections has mailed absentee ballot applications to every past voter. I think the in-person opportunity to vote at the Board of Elections has been in effect since the last day to register, or 5 days before the last day to register.
I think it's March 30th.
And so I think that there are more opportunities to vote, to make it convenient. You don't necessarily have to take time off work or take time off of your family. It's a mail-in application that you can complete at home with the League of Women Voters guide right in front of you.
What do we know about the folks that tend to vote absentee? We know that it used to be that there were certain reasons you could give for doing it, that you had to give a reason, and there were – maybe it was health. Okay. You're out of the country or out of the state, something like that, and you could absentee. But now it's for any reason. So do we know anything about folks who do this?
We have some national data on this. I don't know that we know anything specific about Ohio, but no reason to believe that Ohio is different from the rest of the country. And in general, the statistical data has shown that people who vote absentee tend to be older, more affluent, and they are more likely to be white as opposed to people of color than the average voter. This is why some people, including myself, are worried about going to an entirely male balloting system.
Such as in Oregon?
Such as in Oregon, mm-hmm. Yeah. Oregon and some places in Washington have all-male systems, at least for some elections. And it can at least marginally boost turnout for low turnout elections, which are ones where only state and local issues are on the ballot. But I'm worried about the consequences, what one commentator has called the perverse consequences of going to a system that might actually make the electorate slightly larger but less representative of the people as a whole.
Now, it's been deemed a success, but is that wholly on the numbers that participate and not necessarily on the demographic breakdown? Is that what
I think that at least some people deem it a success. And I was in a conversation a couple years ago with Oregon's Secretary of State, where he was touting it as a success. I was a bit more skeptical of whether it really was a success and whether it should be exported to other places because of the impact that it might have on actually making our electorate less representative of the people as a whole.
Okay. I know the League of Women Voters in Oregon has been supportive of that, but the League of Women Voters of Ohio has had some similar concerns about an entirely vote-by-mail system. It's not a one-size-fits-all. I think every state's culture is different, and we have to make that decision for ourselves.
Yeah, and the way I'd put it is that shutting down polling places is not the way to make our electorate more representative. Now, we have gone to a no-fault absentee system, and as you mentioned a few moments ago, where voters no longer need an excuse as they did prior to 2005 in order to vote an absentee ballot. And I think that's part of the reason why we here in Ohio, as in other states, have seen an increase in the number of people who are choosing to vote absentee.
We have to take a quick break. When we return, Matt Damschroeder, Deputy Director at the Franklin County Board of Elections, will be with us to join us in our conversation with Daniel Tokaji of the Moritz School of Law at Ohio State and also Scott Britton of the League of Women Voters of Ohio. Take your questions and comments as well. These guys know what they're talking about. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You could try Facebook. All Sides Facebook page. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Get the stories behind the headlines every day on All Things Considered.
The numbers are startling. Ohio's maternal death rate has more than doubled over the past two decades. Some suggest the changes in record keeping account for the increase.
Some of it is certainly maybe due to the identification of cases.
She says overall, women are higher risk these days.
On your drive home, listen to award-winning coverage from the WOSU news team on WOSU 89.7 FM.
And this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. 64 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunny skies today and a high of 75. Clear skies tonight and a low of 50 degrees. More sunshine for Wednesday and a high of 82.
Support for WOSU comes from The Other Paper, Columbus's news and entertainment weekly. On newsstands every Thursday and online at theotherpaper.com.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Election Day in Ohio, and we're talking about all sorts of stuff with Daniel Tokaji of the OSU Election Law, Associate Director of Election Law at the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. That's a nice long title, but it's...
You can just say Dan Tokaji of Ohio State's Law School.
I know I could, but... My producers are cringing right now. And also, Scott Britton of the League of Women Voters of Ohio. Scott, welcome back.
Thank you.
And joining us now, Matt Damschroeder, Deputy Director at the Franklin County Board of Elections. Hi, Matt.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
Great, thank you.
Is it a busy day?
You know, it is busy. Not as busy as, for instance, the 2008 general election or even the primary election in 2008, for that matter, but still a busy day.
What we were wondering about the Secretary of State Jennifer Bruner's directive that voters who switch parties in this primary must sign a form saying that they support the principles of the party whose ballot they are requesting. How's that going?
Well, it's going relatively smoothly. I mean, it was a change in practice for many counties, including Franklin. But in terms of the absentees, of the almost 110,000 absentees, only 4,000 were challenged from Democrats switching to Republicans and 700 switching from Republicans to Democrats. So, you know, it's not a huge percentage of the total vote, and my expectation would be that it wouldn't be too dramatically different for Election Day. I think the biggest message for voters is that it's not something to be afraid of, that it's a simple form. They just write their name, sign it, saying, you know, I am affirming that I am indeed switching parties and that I'm upholding the principles of the party I'm switching to. So, and then they vote a regular ballot. So it's not something to be worried about. And I think our poll workers are well positioned to make that process easy for voters.
If someone were to challenge a voter in that case, what would they do? Make them recite the party platform or something? What would that be? What are the principles?
The issue, I think, behind the law as it's interpreted by the Secretary of State is to prevent one party from intentionally raiding the other party's primary in an effort to perhaps select the least strong candidate to run against. But I think in an environment like this, where you have strong primaries in both major parties, there's no incentive for that kind of gamesmanship by any political party. So from, you know, if someone were to, when they sign that form with the poll workers, don't believe the veracity or truthfulness of the statement, then that voter would vote a provisional ballot, which would then count in the official canvas. But we don't expect that to happen. The voter just signs the form and then will vote a regular ballot.
Dan, it seems like so much red tape.
It sure does. And you know, let me first emphasize Matt's point. This is not something for voters to be concerned with. If they want to switch parties, they can go to their regular precinct, sign a form, and the switching of parties will have been accomplished by that. I think that the most significant problems were for those voting absentee. And look, I happen to believe that Secretary of State Bruner interpreted the law correctly in her directive. The timing was unfortunate. This directive was issued at the end of March.
Just before the ballots were going out.
Exactly right, which didn't leave a lot of time for county election officials like Matt to shift gears and comply. And I think that they've done a very good job under the circumstances. But it is a lot of red tape for the voters. And I think one of the things the Ohio legislature might consider doing is changing the law to eliminate this requirement that voters be challenged if a poll worker doubts their eligibility, and one of the bases for doubting it is if they voted in the other party. I mean, it's a poorly written law And probably creates more problems than we need.
How long has that law been around?
I think the law has been around for a while, but this problem of crossover voting really captured public attention in 2008 in the Democratic primary, where Rush Limbaugh, among others, were urging at least some Republican voters, as I recall, to vote in the Democratic primary, and that caused a bit of a stir. I wish this directive from the Secretary of State's office had come out earlier, and I hope that – and I actually think that the law itself is at least potentially subject to a constitutional challenge by one or the other of the major parties. So I think that this is something the Ohio legislature really needs to look at.
And it should be noted, too, I think that it only applies to the major parties, that if you want to switch from a Republican or a Democratic ticket and, say, vote Libertarian or Green this time, you should not be challenged on that. It really is just applying to the switches between the two major parties.
It seems like one of those laws that isn't going to be challenged by one of the major parties because they never know when it might come in handy.
That is potentially true, although we have seen cases in the past where parties have challenged certain ballot access rules and rules about who can vote in their primaries. So and some of those cases have actually made it up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So I actually wouldn't be shocked if one of the major parties decided that they think this is a problem. In fact, I was maybe not surprised, but let me put it this way. I wouldn't have been surprised if the Republican Party in this past election cycle had decided to challenge Secretary of State Bruner's directive. And I think not so much the directive but the underlying law may have been vulnerable in a properly filed case.
Well, I think it also is one of the issues where in a state like Ohio and frankly the entire country that for the general electorate for purposes of November voting, the majority of voters are unaffiliated with either political party, that the practice that Franklin and other counties had that allowed, that encouraged, frankly, participation in a partisan primary election by allowing people to come in and vote for whatever party where the action was. I mean, in 2006, yeah, where there was a Republican primary for governor, not much going on the Democrat side, there were a lot of people switching to Republican. And then, as Dan mentioned, with the Limbaugh issue from 2008, a lot of people were switching to Republican or to Democrat to vote in that primary because, frankly, that's where a lot of the action was by the time we got to March for Ohio. So I think Dan's exactly right. It's an issue that the General Assembly should revisit and decide whether we truly are going to be a closed primary state or an open primary state instead of this kind of hybrid middle thing that we're dealing with now.
And let's face it, I think it can feel intimidating or at least disconcerting to the voter who is confronted with this form they have to sign. They're not sure how it's going to be used. But we need to reemphasize that voters really should not be concerned about how this is going to be used against them. I the only consequence that we've been able to determine might happen is that, a voter couldn't run as a candidate for the opposite party having signed this in the next couple of years. But other than that, I don't think that voters need to fear any concern about signing this form.
Is that the case, that they can't run in the other party?
Well, if a person, and this was actually an issue this year with a couple candidates that voted one major political party's ballot in 2008 and wanted to run for the other political parties, as long as they're not the current office holder, where there's a special process for that situation, they can indeed run and declare their party as a part of that nominating petition process.
Okay, so Jennifer Bruner has asked, and others have called for an open primary system. How would it work? How does an open primary work, since for a lot of people the only place they've ever voted is Ohio?
Well, there's a couple different ways to do it. There's kind of the growing concept of instant runoff or ranked choice kind of voting that could be used as a model for a primary nominating process where all the candidates for office of all the different political parties would run together, similar to what we do in the City of Columbus for nominating candidates for the general, and the top two vote-getters would then go on to the fall to face each other. If it was two Republicans, so be it, or Republican and Democrat, whatever. But I think the more traditional model, and Dan and Scott can chime in as well, is that you still pick a party ballot, but that you're not limited to staying with that party for subsequent elections.
Right.
Many states you have to register with a political party in advance of Election Day in order to participate in the primary. And obviously in Ohio, we're not that kind of state.
Right. And there are, I think, basically three options, right? There's the open primary, which is the one that Matt just mentioned, where for any election you can request any party's ballot and you're not bound by that choice for subsequent elections. There's a closed system, which is sort of what we have, where only party members can vote in primaries. There's a third option, which is sometimes referred to as a blanket primary, and there are versions of this that have been upheld by the Supreme Court in Washington and Louisiana, where basically, you know, in a sense, they're not really primaries at all. Anybody, regardless of party, votes, and all of the candidates of all parties are on the ballot. The top two will go to the runoff election in say November for this year it would be, that's one possible choice that Ohio could make, and it's really the abolition of party primaries as such.
Now, one of my objections, personal to the closed primary, has always been that then people know what party I affiliate with, and so I don't vote in primaries. Would that still be public? What side of the ticket you voted on?
Well, if there was a purely open process, like Dan was just describing, where mm-hmm. all the parties, all the candidates would run in a field for the contest, then you wouldn't really be affiliating with a party in order to access the ballot on primary election.
And there'd
day.
Be no reason then to reveal that.
Yeah, exactly. For the
Correct.
Third choice, okay. I mentioned the blanket primary, where all the candidates appear on every ballot, then no one would know what your
right.
partisan affiliation is. For the first option, you know, which is an open primary, you just go in and choose in each election. I suppose the state could do what it wanted, could make that information public, or could keep it private about which ballot you selected in any given race.
We are talking about voting and all different kinds of voting issues. It is primary voting day in the state of Ohio, and with me is Daniel Tokaji of the OSU School of Law, also Scott Britton of the League of Women Voters of Ohio, and Matt Damschroeder, Deputy Director at the Franklin County Board of Elections. Matt, you're also a member of the Executive Committee at the Franklin County Republican Party.
I am.
And people are supposed to vote for that?
Actually, for County Executive Committee, it's an appointed position.
Okay.
County and State
it's a
Central
state.
Committee
yeah.
are elected positions.
And where would people go to learn more about who they might vote for? And I'm just wondering about the participation level in those as well.
Yeah, the best way for voters to get information for their specific precinct in terms of the candidates and issues that they'll look at today is to actually go to the Board of Elections website, which is vote.franklincountyohio.gov, and there they can click on Find My Voting Location, put in their name or their address, and they can actually look at the sample ballots for all the six political parties, all the candidates, and all the issues, or the issues-only ballot if they just want to vote the issues for that precinct.
Okay, vote.franklincounty.gov. We'll have a link to that on WOSU.org. We have an email from a listener, Stephen. Asks, are there going to be paper ballots available at the polls today? I don't think people realize the importance of the alternative party inclusions on this ballot, i.e. the Socialist and Green Party and the Libertarian Party. So I think those are two questions. First of all, the paper ballots issue. People can do that, but they have to ask for it, right, Matt?
Well, actually, not for this election.
Okay.
The Secretary of State did not issue a directive requiring counties to provide a paper ballot alternative at the polls on Election Day. There is a court decision, actually I think the League of Women Voters decision, that establishes that for federal general elections and presidential primaries, but because this is not a federal general or presidential primary, counties were not required to make that available. So today when the people vote, their option to cast a regular ballot will be the DRE, the touchscreen with the voter verified paper audit trail. If they don't have ID or are moving and voting in their new precinct, they'll vote a paper provisional ballot.
So, but the Secretary of State could have made a directive on that score.
In the past, the Secretary has done that, but I think in the post League of Women Voters lawsuit, I think that most folks were just leaving it up to the consent decree, the consent order to have it just in the federal generals.
And what are the advantages, disadvantages of having that paper ballot option, Dan?
Well, I think it's a good thing to have paper ballots on hand in case machines break down, as they sometimes do. Personally, I don't favor giving the option because I think it gives the false impression that the electronic voting systems are unreliable when, in fact, the data tend to show that they are quite reliable and accurately capture votes. Like any other voting system, if they're not properly implemented, if there aren't proper procedures in place, they can have some security issues. But there are a lot of people who are skeptical of electronic voting systems, and that's why they want the paper option. My concern is if there's not there's not a scanner there that can be used to check to make sure they've not overvoted, that is, you know, mistakenly voted for more than one candidate in a one candidate race, having paper ballots can actually result in more errors than voting with an electronic ballot. But that's my perspective. So I think the bottom line is voters should go to the polls, whatever voting system they're voting on, and be confident that their vote will be counted.
Scott?
Well, I should say that the suit that Matt refers to is actually resulted in a settlement agreement between the League of Women Voters of Ohio and the Secretary of State's office in June of 2009. And our bottom line was that for those critical high-volume elections, paper ballots should be available for those who may not want to wait in line, for those who don't have time to wait in line. And let's face it, there are folks out there who are skeptical about the machines and if they want to have that option, you know, it should be made available to them during those critical elections.
We have to take another break. Matt, are you going to hang in there with us? Or are you
going to
take off? Okay, great. When we return, Matt Damschroeder, of the Deputy Director at the Franklin County Board of Elections, and also Daniel Tokaji, a law professor at Ohio State University, and Scott Britton of the League of Women Voters of Ohio. Questions, comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your questions and comments there. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher at WOSU 820 NPR News.
There are just 2 days left for the opportunity to shorten the WOSU spring membership drive by 1 day. If we raise $20,000 by Wednesday night, we'll take Thursday off, meaning you'll get more of the radio you rely on. But right now, we're relying on you. Make your pledge at WOSU.org/pledgefree. It's fast and easy and will help us reach our overall $175,000 goal. So go online now and get more radio.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of All Sides will be here. The Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act made changes in health care coverage for millions of Americans. And at 11 o'clock, we will hear answers to your questions about specific provisions of the law and when they go into effect. That discussion begins at 11 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 65 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, a high of 75. Clear skies tonight and a low of 50 degrees. More sunshine for Wednesday, a high of 82. And then a 40% chance of rain Wednesday night and a low of 54.
Support for WOSU comes from Meijer. In partnership with the Nature Conservancy, non-invasive plants are available in the Meijer Garden Center. Information is available at nature.meijer.com.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you want to talk about voting today, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. You can question or comment there as well. We have a question now from Marie. You're on the air. Hi, Marie.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I noticed that by going to the campaign finance site for the Secretary of State, Ohio Secretary of State, that a certain candidate used campaign funds to purchase a car. That candidate is John Husted. And I noticed that he withdrew funds from his campaign and used his campaign funds to pay for a car, pay for...
And you wonder...
Is that legal?
Can he do this?
It becomes illegal. I mean, he did it. All that anybody has to do is check the campaign finance. And I was a little surprised. I didn't know something like that would be legal.
Well, yeah, and he didn't try to hide it. So, Dan, what do you say?
I don't know off the top of my head. I think, you know, what I one could, if one believed it was illegal, you could file a complaint with the Federal Election Commission. He is a candidate for federal office
State office.
John Husted.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, yes. But, I'm just going to speculate, Marie. I know that campaigns spend campaign funds on car leases. They need cars to transport their people around and that sort of thing.
But he actually wrote out a check for, what is it, $17,000 or $18,000 to a Ford dealership.
Right.
I mean, whatever that amount of money was. I mean, and I would wonder if someone other than himself were driving that car. Is that illegal? I mean, you know, where's the line here?
Yeah, the campaign finance rules are a specific set of state law, and in both in terms of boards of elections and the Secretary of State's office plays an auditing role of those, and then any irregularities or complaints are forwarded to the Ohio Elections Commission that can hold a probable cause hearing and then render decisions. In the past, campaigns, and I have no reason to believe this is not the case for this election, campaigns have been allowed to purchase vehicles, lease vehicles, rent them in order to provide transportation for the candidate or the candidate staff for political activities. Obviously, the issue becomes, is it being purchased for exclusive personal use, or is it being purchased or leased or rented for campaign use? My guess is that Senator Husted, along with all the other statewide, almost all the other statewide office holders and candidates who do incur and expenses for travel around the state do have the campaign pay for all or a portion of those expenses. So my guess is that this is probably a perfectly legitimate expense, but question can be directed to the Elections Commission.
I'm into these little details, so I haven't seen anyone else do such a thing, so I'm not aware of that.
I think it's really interesting that you went online and you checked out those reports. I think that's pretty cool. You know, there was a day when they weren't online, and the only people that really saw them in detail were State House reporters who, toddled on down to the Ohio Secretary of State's office and went through the reams and reams and reams of paper. And if it sounds like I know what I'm talking about, I do. I did it. It was very irritating.
Okay. So. All right. Well, I thank you for your input.
Thanks Marie.
Bye-bye.
We have a question, an email, and then we have a caller that both want to ask about the same thing, sort of. Dan, you're on the air. You want to talk about trust?
Sure. Yes. I was an election observer in the last election, and it was my observation that in the vote tallying system, this was in Westerville, there was electronic voting machines. There was a machine that only functioned for a short while, maybe an hour or less, and then they had trouble with it, so they stopped using it. My question is, why would you put a finger drive or a vote counting mechanism in a voting computer that had flaws when you know viruses are a fact of life in this electronic world, in this computer software-driven world? Why would you do that, first of all? And the second thing was, I was an observer, and I questioned the judge about why you would tally the votes with that mechanism when you're going to put it in all the other machines, and he threatened to throw me out of the polling place. Why, without any transparency, should we trust a system like that?
Yeah, Dan?
I'm going to throw this one to Matt.
Oh, Matt. Okay.
Yeah.
He's throwing it to you, Matt.
Sorry. That's fine. I would say that I think the fact that you were an observer underscores that there is transparency in the system.
No. The software.
Right. I'm answering your second question first.
Okay. Let him talk.
Yeah, I'm going to answer your second question first. And that there is transparency, it's a bipartisan process with equal numbers of Republicans and Democrats overseeing the process, and with public records requests and other things, it is a transparent system. In terms of the technology issue, if there is a machine problem on Election Day, just because there is what is potentially viewed by a voter or an observer or even a poll worker as a machine problem doesn't necessarily mean that it's an electronic problem. In most cases, it's a paper jam on the voter verified paper audit trail. But if there is a problem, what we ask the poll workers to do is contact the Board of Elections. We have a special number just for them. We can dispatch a machine technician there to help resolve the problem. Or if there's a larger issue with the machine, then we just don't use it for the rest of the day. What you may be referring to when you're talking about doing the accumulation, it's not actually a thumb drive. It's a proprietary device with the voting system that has an individual election, what's called an EQC code, election qualification code, 8 digits, 4 known, 4 not known, that's built into the system each election when we program it. And that device called the PEB, which is inserted in the machine, that accumulates all the results from each of the machines, for us then to upload at the Board of Elections. In the case, when it does happen from time to time, if there is a machine that does have some kind of error on it that can't be resolved in the field, we'll bring that back to our office that night. It won't have the votes added in the accumulating process with that PEB, and we do it separately on election night to make sure that there aren't any losses from that machine. So, you know, we feel that, you know, it's as Dan mentioned earlier, that, you know, there are sometimes there are machine problems, but we feel that our processes and our procedures protect that process and prevent against any concerns that you might raise.
And let me say this in response to the caller's specific story. You know, I do think it's a problem if an observer is kicked out or threatened to be kicked out for raising a concern about something that he or she sees, which isn't, in the observer's view, according to procedures. So if there is some sort of problem that the observer notes, that observer ought to bring that to the attention of the Board of Elections and so that the Board of Elections can properly investigate after the fact if things aren't in fact being done according to the procedures that Matt just laid out.
Dan, thanks for your call.
And can I still talk?
Very quickly.
Yes. Now, remember, you are trying to count, or you're trying to, if you're calling transparency, just trusting in blind faith in people who wrote the programs for these machines, and that machine that counts the votes, where is that transparency? That is just transparency in word alone. It's not transparency that the voters can actually see.
Okay. All right. Dan, thanks for your call.
Well, I would just add that, there is the machines, yes, there are vendors, multiple vendors that boards of elections across the country can buy their equipment from. They are individual for-profit corporations that do provide that service. Machines are certified to, and now certified to federal standards. They're certified by the Secretary of State in Ohio for use in the state. There are pre-election tests that are open to the public, published on our website, that we would love to have folks come down and watch. When a voter casts their ballot electronically on the touch screens, there's not only triple electronic redundancy of their vote inside the voting machine, but there's also that permanent paper record of the voter verified paper audit trail that they can see being created. And that record actually becomes the ballot of record in the case of an audit or a recount when the electronic results are within 0.5%.
Yeah, I like that thing. The trust issue didn't used to be an issue. We were all growing up, you know, we had the best voting system in the world, and we felt very, very confident of that until about 2000, when we questioned how the voting machines actually work, and we had the hanging chad issue. I still have my Christmas ornament from that. We have an email from another listener who's asking, hearkening back to the election of 2004, that horrible rainy day when the voting lines in throughout, particularly in the inner city, were extremely long, and some people couldn't stay. You know, they had to leave, and of course that spurred in part, the call for the paper ballot to give them an option. But The emailer wonders if it's possible for those in charge of elections to see how this might potentially impact the outcome of the presidential election that year. And so I'm wondering, I wonder too, 6 years later, have we learned anything from that? Do we know anything about how that affected the outcome or learned anything otherwise, Dan?
I'm pretty confident that the lines that we saw in 2004 are very unfortunate, but that they didn't affect the outcome given the substantial margin of victory for former President George W. Bush in Ohio. Now, that said, it's really difficult to say for sure exactly how many people were discouraged from voting due to long lines, but it would have had to have been an enormous amount for that to have affected the outcome.
Now, the League of Women Voters lawsuit didn't question the results mm-hmm. of the election, but you know, the thrust of our concern is that there was quite a bit of inconsistency amongst the 88 county boards of elections regarding how voters were treated, with everything from voter registration to the use of voter identification to provisional ballots. And our lawsuit sought to address those inconsistencies in particular to make sure that a voter in Franklin County, where you know we do have a great staff, we've got a lot of resources, we've got great oversight by both parties, is treated the same as a voter in a smaller, more rural county that maybe doesn't have the same level of resources. We want to make sure that there's consistency across the board and that the systems in place, even though human error can never be overcome completely, that there are systems in place to safeguard those sorts of errors.
Matt, you were the director mm-hmm. at the Franklin County Board of Elections that year.
I was.
What'd you learn?
Well, I think we learned a lot of things, and I think one of the most important things that came out of the 2004 election was the change in state law, I think somewhat spurred on by the League of Women Voters ballot issues in 2005 to create no-fault absentee and to allow more people to take advantage of the opportunity to vote before Election Day. So when we came to 2008, we saw that almost half of the total ballots cast for that election were cast before Election Day, 55,000 in person at Vets Memorial and another 210,000 by mail, so that when you come to Election Day, where your resources are fixed, both in terms of the size of the location, the number of voting machines that you have the ability to purchase, and the number of poll workers you can assign at a location, that you've offloaded a portion of that demand for those resources to the 35 days before Election Day. So I think that's the most important statewide development in terms of state law that came out of 2004.
Scott?
I should clarify that those Reform Ohio Now amendments weren't the League of Women Voters
amendments. I'm sorry.
Amendments. That's all right. But we did endorse a couple of them, but they weren't they didn't originate with the League.
The voter ID directive, why is that a directive in Ohio?
Well, we've got a state law as well as federal law under the Help America Vote Act mm-hmm. that requires voter identification. Doesn't require photo ID, but you can present a driver's license or an official state identification card, military identification card, or another document with your name and current address, such as a utility bill or a government document. And the Secretary of State has issued a directive which clarifies some of the ambiguities that were created by Ohio law. This was as a result of a lawsuit filed in the Northern District of Ohio in federal court. So, for example, current is specifically defined in that directive to mean either, for example, for a driver's license, one that's not expired, or for another document, one that was issued in the last year. So we've got a state statute that was passed by the legislature, and then we've got a directive that fills in some of the gaps.
Matt, are people getting used to this kind of stuff now?
I think so, but I think the biggest challenge that because there's so many variations. If you look at the flow chart of the if this, then that mm-hmm. kind of series of questions that poll workers are faced with, all the different kinds of identification, really creates a lot of confusion on the part of some poll workers. And sometimes, unfortunately, they just get frustrated and say, well, we'll just have you vote a provisional if the Board of Elections figured out after Election Day. That's obviously not the proper course. Mm-hmm. The biggest challenge that I think we see is for a voter who has moved changed their address with the Board of Elections, which is required in order to cast a regular ballot on Election Day in their new precinct. But because their driver's license is not expired, they didn't go and get a new driver's license to update their address.
I've never done that before.
Exactly. And I think the driver's license in mine still has my old address. So in that situation, that driver's license is valid identification in order to cast a regular ballot. So even if it has the driver's license has the former address, as long as the information in the poll book is up to date, they can cast a regular ballot in their correct precinct.
Okay, let's take another call, 614-292. We only have a couple minutes left. And, Chris, you voted. You're a switcher. How did it go?
I went to the Board of Election last week, and I switched parties from Republican to Democrat so I could vote in the Fisher-Bruner race. And I was asked to sign the challenge form, a little bright red form, and I found it to be quick and easy and completely pointless. I wonder if I had refused to sign that, would I still have been able to vote?
Yes, you would have voted a provisional ballot as opposed to having to vote the regular absentee vote, that ballot that you cast last week when you voted in person at the office. And that would be the case today for voters voting a regular ballot who are challenged because they're switching parties. If they refused to fill out the form, they would vote a provisional ballot, and that would then count after the election.
It's one of those things. I think the threat of a challenge is more potent than the actual challenge itself. It might discourage someone from showing up at the polls at all.
So, in the intimidation factor, you mean?
Yeah, and I think I tend to agree with the caller's perspective that it's quick, easily, and totally pointless. And I think this is another reason for the Ohio legislature to revisit the law. And to go to either pure open, pure closed, or some sort of blanket primary system.
Thanks, caller. Appreciate it, Chris.
Thank you.
We have run out of time. I want to say thanks to my guest, Daniel Tokaji of the OSU Moritz College of Law, and also Scott Britton of the League of Women Voters of Ohio, and Matt Damschroeder, Deputy Director of the Franklin County Board of Elections. Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ann.
Yep. Take care. All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.